When you're in San Francisco, it's easy to overlook Richmond. It's across the water, across a long bridge in the East Bay. It's known as being scrappy, transitional. Your chance of becoming a victim of violent crime there is twice as high as in California as a whole. But Richmond's kind of charming, really. And it has a story to tell. Early in the American century, it helped change the course of a war abroad and of American society at home. And in this episode, one extraordinary woman who is part of that story and is nearing a century herself will help tell that tale. This is Whose Century Is It? I'm Mary Kay Magstead. So, this podcast is about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century, which generally means casting forward. But sometimes it's worth looking back, because some of the ideas, trends, and twists helping to shape this century are on a long arc that started decades ago. So, cast back to the early 40s. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, the Nazis are on the march.
This is what we are fighting. Freedom's oldest enemy. The passion of the few to rule the many. This isn't just a war. It's us or them. 170 years of freedom decrees our answer.
Before a gun can fire, a tank can roll, a ship can float, thousands upon thousands of men and women must work to get them ready. American armies are on the march, and forward with them, the unsung millions of soldiers without guns march on to final victory.
Richmond shipyards, owned by Henry Kaiser, took a cue from the mass production techniques at the neighboring Ford Auto Plant and started churning out ships, more than 740 of them by war's end. And with so many men off fighting, women were encouraged to step up. It was the era of Rosie the Riveter.
She's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sabotage. Sitting up there on the fuselage, that little friend can do more than a man can do. Rosie.
So, okay, the tone was a little patronizing. Social norms don't change overnight. And indeed, after the war, men took the jobs back from women, and the women were expected to go back to being housewives, as many did in the 1950s, before the women's movement erupted. But social change did come from this moment in American history. All these voices and the music that you're hearing are from a museum in Richmond that's worth visiting, because it tells the story of that change. It's the Rosie the Riveter Museum, and it's just near the old Ford plant on the water's edge. It has displays, films, a model riveting machine, and talks. And one talk in particular regularly fills the room. A petite older woman in a brown park ranger uniform pulls up a stool, sits with perfect posture, and begins.
Can we have a light all around? I like to see faces.
This is Betty Reed Soskin, the nation's oldest park ranger. She's 94. Back in the days of Rosie the Riveter, she was here in Richmond as a 20-year-old clerk. She starts her presentation with a film that tells the mainstream story about how the war effort changed women's lives. It includes reflections from former workers here.
I was very proud of myself that I worked in the shipyards. Proud of myself because I thought we were doing something for the war effort.
From that point on, I always thought, I can do anything I want to do. If I set my mind to it, I can do anything. And that's how I've lived the rest of my life.
This was the place to be. What sticks with me the most was how wonderful everybody was to each other. Very patriotic and pulling together, and it was just a good time.
That's what makes the story so interesting, that these were ordinary people who did extraordinary things.
As the credits roll, Betty, who's African-American, a Cajun Creole from New Orleans whose parents moved to Oakland when she was six, says she didn't much like this film when she first saw it, because Rosie the Riveter was a white woman's story.
My disappointment came from the fact that
that history had been contracted, and that because when you give up your complexity, you give up much of your truth. If you're going to try to tell a story with as many moving parts as this story had in 15 minutes, what do you do? You go for the Hollywood ending. You know, we all got together for the sake of democracy, and we set our differences aside, and we built the ships, and we won the war. That tends to be the way history gets recorded.
If you were African American, she says, it was all a little more complicated than that.
And if you knew the sequence in which people were hired, first to be hired were the men who were too old to fight. Second, the boys who were too young to be drafted. Third, single white women. I mean, that pool's exhausted. Married white women. And not until 1943, the first of black men to be hired as helpers and trainees only to do the heavy lifting for the women that they've brought on board. And though there were some black women who worked as laborers, sweeping the decks while other people worked, it wasn't until late in 1944 and early in 1945 that black women began to be trained as welders. And if you know that sequence, you know that those pictures on our wall upstairs or in this room with all these people standing together and brothers and sisters, all shapes, all sizes, all colors, all races, all nationalities, all genders, everybody standing together as brothers and sisters. And we see that because we come from a more enlightened age. We see that as the brotherhood, the fellowship of World War II, and we wonder why we can't do that now. What we don't recognize is that that picture has to date from late in 1944 or early in 1945, because in 1942 you couldn't have gotten to stand together and have their pictures taken. But that gives you an actual sense of the acceleration of social change, which was initiated during those years here in the Bay Area.
The change started with shipyard owner Henry Kaiser recruiting African Americans in the South to come and work in Richmond.
He knew all he needed was enough hands. He didn't care what color they were, and he didn't care who they were connected to. He just needed enough hands. And he knew where the greatest pool of available existed in the country. The five southern states, Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, and Louisiana, which is where he did his major recruiting. Whites coming off the Dust Bowl, blacks coming off the mechanization of cotton, everybody rising from the Great Depression, sharecroppers ready to drop their hoes in the fields and come out and be shipbuilders with Mr. Kaiser. It's possible for a black man to be standing on the sidewalk in Jackson, Mississippi, where Southern tradition would demand that he step off into the gutter if a white person approached. That man could find himself tapped on the shoulder by a Kaiser recruiter, and 2 weeks later be in the city of Richmond, riding in the front of the bus, 10 years before Rosa Parks would refuse to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama. You've got black people coming out here as migrant workers with hope and expectations for a better life to be met by white people coming out here, Southerners, expecting a continuation of white privilege, and into a city with a population of 23,000. Into that small city, Henry Kaiser would bring in a workforce of 98,000 black and white Southerners who are not going to be sharing drinking fountains, schools, housing, any kind of public accommodations for another 20 years back in their places of origin. That's not going to happen until the 60s. We are talking 1942. And no time for focus groups or diversity training. They have got to negotiate every day as it comes, at the personal level. No time to take on a broken social system. Only time to take on the mission of their leader, which is simply pure and simple. Build ships faster than the enemy can sink them. That's all. And behind a man who referred to the bow of the ship as a pointy end. Seriously, the pointy end. They completed 747 ships in 3 years and 8 months.
Yes.
747 ships. A feat that's never been matched, nor will it be. They worked around the clock, 24 hours a day, three ships, 364 days. Only was Christmas off. By way of comparison, Mr. Moore at Moore Dry Dock in Oakland, who was a traditional shipbuilder who'd been building ships since the First World War, completed 100. Bechtel Corporation at Sausalito Marine Ship completed 93. And Henry Kaiser and his merry band of sharecroppers completed 747 ships, and by outproducing the enemy right here, helped to turn the course of the war around and end it. Right here.
It's a pretty incredible story, but so is Betty's own. As a young woman, she knew her great-grandmother, who'd been born into slavery in 1846 in St. James Parish, Louisiana. She was a slave until age 19, when she was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. She lived to be 102.
That means that I was a full-grown woman, a mother by that time, 27 years old when my slave ancestor died. I knew her as a matriarch of my family. And on January 20th of 2009, I'm a seated guest on the Capitol Mall with a picture of my great-grandmother in my breast pocket, witnessing the inauguration of America's first African-American president in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial, whose life was contemporary with the life of my great-grandmother. That's how fast the time goes.
Betty was also invited to introduce President Obama at this past year's White House Christmas tree lighting ceremony.
It is fitting that I've returned to Washington tonight with my granddaughters in an area known as the Ellipse, because this is a full circle moment.
She says it was the thrill of a lifetime, and she still sleeps with the presidential seal he gave her beneath her pillow.
It occurred to me some months ago, when I sat up in bed one night, wide awake, I don't know what I was dreaming, but it occurred to me that if I could make a template of that timeline from 1846 and my great-grandmother's birth to my still being here, but if I moved it ahead 100 years so that it starts not in 1846, but 1946, what looms into view is the fact that those of us in this room, by what we do or fail to do, over the next few years may well determine whether or not our grandchildren inherit a livable planet. Because that's how fast the time goes.
In her own time, Betty has moved from being a 20-year-old clerk in a Jim Crow union hall to a wife and mother whose family got death threats for buying a home in a white suburb. They live there anyway. To successful co-owner of a music shop, to legislative staff for local city council members, to, around age 80, becoming a park ranger and making sure the African-American experience was part of the story being told at the Rosie the Riveter Museum.
Because the nature of democracy is it will never stay fixed. That wasn't what it was created to do. It's a dynamic system. It is not static. It is dynamic. Every generation has to recreate democracy in its day. Every generation. It won't stay fixed because we have a constitutionally protected right to be wrong. We have a constitutionally protected right to be bigots. We also have created for ourselves this incredible system of national parks where we are free to go back and revisit any era in our history. The heroic places, the scenic wonders, the contemplative places, the shameful places, and the painful places. We can revisit those eras in order to own that history and process it, in order to forgive ourselves so that we can move together toward a more compassionate future. That's what this part is for me.
And over time, she says, she's made her peace with that film she shows at the beginning of her talk.
There's a place on the film where Agnes Moore, a still-living Rosie Riveter, living in Rossmore, she says on the film, it was really the greatest coming together of the American people that I have ever lived through. And when this film was first released to us, and I would stand against the wall and watch the faces of the audience as she uttered those words, and I'd think, how can she say that? She knows that's not true. I mean, how can she possibly do that? And somewhere around about my 90th birthday, I aged into a place where I began to hear that. To be able to hear that is Agnes's truth. That was an accurate, literate expression of her reality. And I began to understand the concept of conflicting truths, that we all have conflicting realities and conflicting truths which we develop ourselves, and that there are many truths out there, and as long as there's a place on the planet where Agnes's truth and mine can coexist, that's enough for me, and that's what this place became. And I hope it becomes that for you.
People crowd in after Betty's talk to thank her and tell her how much what she said means to them. Many are return visitors. Others want to come back and bring friends to see her. And they ask when she'll be speaking.
There are ranger programs every day at 2 o'clock, 7 days a week. And I just do the one.
You mean there are three or four more 95-year-olds?
No. I'm the vintage ranger.
The audience drifts out. Betty checks her email on her phone, runs around to take care of a couple of things that have come up, and then we walk over to get a bite and chat at a nearby factory-turned restaurant.
You talk about the arc of your experience over almost a century here in Richmond, in California, where you grew up in New Orleans, and you describe an incredible transformation that happened to our society. When you look at where we are now, how do you feel about where we are as a nation, where we are in terms of race relations, where we are in terms of tolerance?
You know, I think that at 94, my sense of myself as an evolving person in an evolving nation, in an evolving universe, is not as I would have described myself even 20 years ago. That I'm much, much more aware. When I was younger, much younger, I considered, well, maybe through the 60s, when I was active in the Civil Rights Revolution, I considered the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, as birthrights. You know, these were like deeds, insured me, and they backed up my actions, justified my feelings. And now I see them more as blueprints with which each generation has to recreate democracy. I see democracy now as an evolving form of governance that requires full participation by all of us. So that my expectations are very different. If the nation had become what I demanded it become in the 60s, and when I was marching with all the other folks, it might not have been what I needed it to be in my 80s. So that right now, I have mixed feelings. I watch the campaigns, the political campaigns for the presidency. And at times, it looks like a caricature of my country. It's almost cartoonish. I wonder if this is really where we're going or where we even want to go. I'm wondering what I should be doing. And when in those times, I feel depressed. And then there are other times when I lock into the fact that of that transformation that's possible, and I see the chaotic periods as times of redefinition. And when people began to hit the streets, and Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter and all of that, it seems to me, are part and parcel of that
coming transformation, and I see it as hopeful. And that, when I think in those terms, it excites me and enriches my work because I see it against that backdrop.
What kind of responses have you gotten from different kinds of audiences who have heard your talk?
I am always amazed that there's never any pushback. If there are people who are objecting to what I'm saying, they don't speak up. I can usually tell where they are because they'll ask irrelevant questions, like how many ships were built, because they can't go with the emotions that are upturned. I can see eyes light up when they get it and when they freeze in place. But something about my talks, I think because they're so personal, I'm not accusing anyone. I'm not being confrontational. I'm saying this is what happened to me. I'm saying this is what my life consisted of. I think that they sometimes don't process this until they leave and think about it. But what is encouraging is the numbers of people who are returnees. I have audiences, and at least a third of them are here because they're bringing friends. That's astounding.
It speaks volumes about the power of the story you're telling. What about, do you get, younger African Americans from, say, Oakland?
Occasionally, I do. I think the main part of my audience are really the suburbanites who are coming to revisit their own history, and they're white. Because if you remember or ever knew that the GI Bill made possible the building of the suburbs, because the GI Bill was administered locally and not federally as it should have been, the local banker could determine who was going to get loans where. So that all around the country, around the boom towns, there grew up the suburbs that were all white. And it was that point that the infill of the cities became people of color. So that the bulk of the people who are visiting this park are coming from Marin County, they're coming from Diablo Valley, they're coming from Sacramento, they're coming from all around. We don't have that many African-American visitors. They are growing, but you have to remember that this was a period of rejection for black folks. We don't have any reason to be nostalgic about World War II. That period does not speak to us, not at all. If you visit a Veterans Day, for instance, I worked the Red Oak Victory the first years I worked for the National Parks, and all day I was on that ship, and here were the veterans of that period coming to stand together to be comrades again, and only one African American boarded the ship that day. And then I realize, oh, wow, this period is celebrating a segregated armed forces. And there's no black veteran that has any reason to be nostalgic about that period. And that's also true for our visitor center. They're only now beginning to come because word is being spread that our history is being told openly and rightly and true, with truth. And so they're becoming a part of my we the people. They are becoming a part of me. And so they hear me, that I speak for them. And African Americans come up and embrace me at the end of my presentations. And it's so heartwarming. But it's because I know that my story is a story that many, many people lived, and that's the power in it. It's not personal, not at all. It's being told personally through me. But it's this history that lived by a whole generation of African Americans, and I'm giving voice to that, and I know it.
I mean, you're really doing two things. You're giving voice to this story, but also by your own living example. You're kind of showing, you know, whatever your circumstances are now, you have some agency. You can do something to transform your own life. And I heard you say in at least one other interview, so I was listening up before I came, that you make a point of wearing your ranger uniform when you travel around town.
Because each time I am on the streets in that ranger hat and in the uniform, I'm announcing to every young kid of color, I'm announcing a career choice that they might not have thought of. And I take very seriously the wearing of the uniform. One day I was standing in Safeway, a supermarket, in checkout line, and there was an African-American woman standing behind me. And as we waited, and I was in uniform, she asked, "Do you work at the prison?" And it occurred to me that San Quentin is just over the hill, and that her association with uniforms was prison. And that spoke volumes to me.
You said there are things about the current situation that are really kind of depressing for you. Is this one of those things where you thought, by now, surely, we as a nation would have moved beyond this?
Yeah, there's irony in that. And yeah, that's painful. But the other thing that's hopeful for me is that when I was looking at the pictures of Ferguson, for instance, the riots, people on the streets or behind Michael Brown or Tamir Rice, and these young people who have been recently killed by police. And the protesters are now interracial. In the 60s, when I was marching, the people around me were mostly black people. We were all fighting for our rights. Now there are people in the streets fighting for American rights and justifications, and they are every color. You know, I mean, they're interracial. I mean, that says a lot. We are outraged as Americans. And I'm a part of that we.
So when you hear people like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz on the campaign trail, and you hear things like, let's have a religious test on whether we allow people to immigrate into this country, let's maybe have Muslims in this country wear some identifying marker, which sounds scarily like wearing a Jewish star.
I hear them as being in the death throes of white supremacy. I really do. I think that their day has passed. I think that there is a visceral... There's a fear at the level, at the cellular level of Obama, of the president and the first lady. And that was, I was aware of that when I was in Washington, in that those few instances when I was standing in front of them in that tent meeting them. She is physically beautiful, and nothing that I've ever, no picture I've ever seen could do her justice as she is in life. And you get this sense, because they were towering over me. They're 6 feet, both of them. But you get this sense of power, of that they put the lie to white supremacy. And at a time when we are fast moving toward a non-majority nation. But you have to understand that there were 4,725 black people lynched between Reconstruction and the 60s. That was 1,500 more than died at the World Trade Center. We have experienced domestic terrorism as a people. And I think that those of us who have helped to redefine democracy during the Civil Rights Movement and all of the iterations that have happened since that time, because this is all really waves of the same thing, that we probably have more of a sense of what it means to be an American than anybody else does. We believe in America. I believe in America. I believe in the possibility and the potential of what is America, at least in the ideal.
What would you like to see happen that would better empower or even self-empower people within this country who now feel themselves to be disempowered?
I don't know. I'm not... My investment is running out because I'm 94. I don't expect to be living into significant answers before I'm gone. and I say that with almost no regrets. I fear what's going to happen to us. I don't know if time's going to run out before we solve the environmental problems. So part of me is winding down. I'm aware of being in my final decade. And so I'm not invested in those answers anymore, really. I'm just going to push as far as I can as long as I'm here.
If you'd like to learn more about Betty and the Rosie the Riveter Museum, or see a print version of this story with photos and other extras, visit our webpage at pri.org/century, or subscribe on iTunes or most other podcast apps, or listen on SoundCloud or Stitcher. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. And if you have comments or ideas for future podcasts, I'd love to hear them. Please send me a message at my Twitter account. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Come on back and listen in.